Christian Rob McGregor welcome you to a place where all kinds of phenomena flourish. Voices whisper, ancient secrets, signs and symbols are abundant. UFOs, ETs, ghosts, and even the dead move about freely. Here we meet authors, researchers, and investigators of the mysterious, the strange, and of the inexplicable anomalies that surround us. Step out of the everyday world and take a journey into the mystical underground.
Welcome to the Mystical Underground. Thank you for joining us. This is Trish McGregor.
And Rob McGregor.
And our producer and tech magician, John Posey. You can go to themysticalunderground.com where we make regular blog posts and where you can find out about our books. Among them are Phenomena, Harnessing Your Psychic Abilities, The Secrets of Secrets, The Secrets of Spirit Communication, Sensing the Future, and Aliens in the Backyard. Our latest book is Mind-Blowing Synchronicities, The Latest Science Stories and Research. Trish's latest novel is White Crows, and Rob's latest nonfiction is Breathe, a Master Diver's Survival Tales, a collaboration with Rick Bedewa.
Our guest today is Jim Willis, author of Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys, and Revelations. Jim is a theologian, historian, and musician. He has been an ordained minister for over 40 years. And while serving as an adjunct college professor in the field of comparative religion and cross-cultural studies, he was the host of his own Drive Time radio show. Upon retirement, Jim was determined to confront the essential mystical reality that has inspired humankind since the very beginning of time. His background in theology and education led to his writing more than 20 books on religion, the Apocalypse, Cross-Cultural Spirituality, and Arcane or Forgotten Cultures, specializing in research bridging lost civilizations, suppressed history, and the study of earth energy, dowsing, and now out-of-body experiences. Welcome, Jim.
It's good to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you. Gee, thanks for that intro, Rob. You made me sound so interesting. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Jim, you moved into the woods in South Carolina, leaving your old life behind. Yeah. Tell us about that transition and what was that like and why did you do it?
I've always been a seeker, but back in the 70s when I just got out of school and I had a degree in music and I had been to seminary and I got out and I had this crazy idea that somehow when you became a church pastor, you were joining this community of like-minded people who wanted to grow spiritually and confront God, or confront spirit, you know, and grow together. And I quickly learned it just doesn't work like that. When you become a pastor of a church, you're basically a CEO of a small company. You know, you've got to worry about things like budgets and attendance on Sunday, and you've got to be a part-time pastor, but you've also got to be a part-time economist, and you've got to be a part-time fixer-upper and worry about buildings, and then you got to be a part-time counselor. And 40 years goes by, and all of a sudden you say, what happened? You came into this thing with the idea of really confronting the idea of spirituality, and instead you get bogged down in, dare I say it, religion and things like that, and other stuff. And when I reached the age of 62, although I had had times when I was transported, and when I felt like I was in touch with the other, the bigger than ourselves, still, it wasn't what I had expected. And I was afraid I was going to waste this life if I didn't do something. So at the age of 62, I couldn't afford it, but I did it anyway. I signed up for Social Security and retired. And I came out here to the woods of South Carolina. And I built a house, and I had to build a road back to the house. And I decided I was just going to, I even had a Bible verse in mind. I had that picture in mind of the Old Testament story of Jacob wrestling with God before his name was changed to Israel, which means he wrestles with God. And I thought I was going to get back here and I was going to wrestle with God. Just you and me, God, you know, no holds barred, 24 hours a day. I was going to go on retreat for 1 year. And I was really going to confront the essential spiritual reality. I just wanted to go into a meditation that wasn't going to be drowned out by the noise of the world or pushed aside by the busyness of the world or anything like that. And so I came out here to stay for 1 year in the woods, and that was 16 years ago. And I'm still here somewhere. There is a follow-up to this story. You know, I had told you that Bible verse, Jacob wrestling with God saying, I will not let you go until you bless me. That was here. A number of years ago, I had no idea where that phrase just popped into my head. But a number of years ago, I was asked to travel to Cornwall in the UK and give a talk there about the roots of world religions and the commonalities between world religions. And so I went to Cornwall, had a wonderful time, but I had never been to England before. And I said, you know, before I go home, I've got to make a little trip up to this town called Fenny Compton up northwest of London, because that's where my ancestors, my great, I don't know how many great ancestors used to preach up there. They were a clergy in the Church of England. So I went up and I met the town historian and stayed at a wonderful little bed and breakfast up there. And I met her the next morning and she took me into this church where my ancestor used to preach, a little stone church. And the same stained glass windows were still there. And I was able to walk up into the pulpit where my ancestor preached. And up there, I stood in that pulpit and looked. And there was a stained glass window that was best seen only from that pulpit. And lo and behold, I'd never seen this in a stained glass window before. It was a picture of Jacob wrestling with God, saying, I will not let you go until
Oh, that's a good synchronicity.
I don't know how his spiritual DNA passed down to me, but it did. But at any rate, I came out here, and that was my prayer. I will not let you go until you bless me. Well, little did I know that my prayer was going to be answered. It didn't come through Christianity. I suppose that wouldn't have worked because for 40 years I just been going through so much of the motions. If spirit was going to speak to me, it was going to be through something else. So my prayer was answered. I wrestled with God, but the answer came through probably the world's oldest religion, shamanism. And I started having out of body experiences, and I started dowsing for earth energies, and pretty soon that led to dowsing for spirit guides, that kind of thing. And it was just a totally different thing. So 16 years and I'm still growing, but that's how it happens out here.
How do you douse for a spirit guide?
Well, you know, there is a, rather than just talk about it in a few minutes, if people go to my webpage, jimwillis.net, I recently did a whole seminar on dowsing for spirit guides with the British Society of Dowsers.
Oh, wow.
And they have given us permission to put it up on our webpage. And you can go to the webpage and click on it. And is a whole PowerPoint thing and everything else. But basically, it's just a matter of to put it in a nutshell, I guess, I've come to believe that our bodies are aware of things that our minds are not. I like to use the idea of the old television, the old black and white televisions we used to have with the rabbit ears on top.
Right.
And you would see a picture on the screen and you wouldn't realize that these television waves are coursing right through the body and everything until you pick up those rabbit ears and you change them and the picture changes on the screen and you realize your body is getting all of these television waves and sound waves and everything coming through, but you're just not aware of it with your mind. And so in effect, the the rabbit ears become a set of dowsing rods. Huh. And it's the same thing here. We have been taught through our lives, not only by other people, but by the kind of life we lead, that the way to, encounter life is through the five senses. We live in this side, this fivefold fence of touch and taste and hearing and smell and that kind of thing. And so that's how we react to the world, usually with our minds, but our bodies are aware of things that we're not. And so I have come to believe that in my case, the first spirit guide that I contacted, I'd come to believe that he was actually me on the other side, the side
that interesting.
Was where I was before I came to this material world. And as a result, the physicists would say we are entangled. My body is aware of that spirit guide who I gave the name to Sabuko, and you'll have to read one of my books to find out where that name came from. But our bodies are aware of that. And as a result, we can douse our bodies. And unfortunately, with dowsing rods, you can only get yes and no answers, but you can become very sophisticated and carry on conversations because our very bodies are aware of messages that we are constantly receiving from the other side, but they come in below our level of consciousness because we're responding only with our minds, with our intellect. And so that's how I learned to douse. And I've got to say, there were times in my Christian ministry when I couldn't feel farther from God, when everything was falling apart. And there were times when I felt cut off and just totally here in this world with no ground of being underneath me. But since I learned how to douse for the information from spirit guides, and I do it every day, I've never once been disappointed. Not
now, do you use rods?
No. I use dowsing rods, or sometimes I use pendulum. Whichever is convenient, but mostly I use dowsing rods. And it's kind of subtle, because normally if you're going to be thinking about dowsing, well, the first rule of dowsing is you've got to be totally concentrated on what you're doing. Mm-hmm. If you're dowsing for water, for instance, and you're thinking about what you're going to have for lunch, you're not going to find any water. But if you're totally concentrated on water, then yeah, you can find water. On the other hand, I noticed that when I first started feeling the presence of this spirit guide, who I could see wanted to come through, and the rods were just kind of vibrating, I immediately put my thought to out there, thinking a foreign landscape with a foreign spirit guide. And as a result, I wasn't doing too well. But when I concentrated and realizing I wasn't going to be dowsing out there, I was going to be dowsing in here, in my own body, then all of a sudden, I began to catch things. So in effect, I could bypass the brain and understand through a visible force, in this case, dowsing rods, a visible thing, I could understand what my body was experiencing. I could start to feel some of those television waves coming at me, you know, change the picture on the rabbit ears a little bit. And it has literally changed my life. It really has.
So the dowsing rods are like a tool for transformation or for communication, right? That's very
interesting. I think so.
Yes, I never heard of anybody dowsing for spirits. That's unique.
Well, it does tend to eliminate one problem, and that's that I think we can be easily led astray. Our egos sometimes get in the way. And if we only can concentrate, at least for left brain thinkers like myself, if we only concentrate on our intuition, it's very easy to fool ourselves, I've found, at least me. Very easy for me to fool myself and begin to start hearing things that aren't there and seeing things that aren't there. But with the dowsing rods, it's a mechanical tool that really shows a spiritual reality. Now, it takes a lot of work. For instance, I went up to the Monroe Institute, and I studied for a week up there with Bill Buhlman, who was probably one of the foremost teachers of out-of-body experiences. And I learned there. I learned from some mentors over of mine over in Cornwall, who were very veteran dowsers, and would I learned it's just so easy to lead ourselves down the primrose path. and begin to believe what we want to believe. At least for me, I say we. Everybody's different, but mm-hmm. for me, that's a snare. It's a pitfall. I can very easily convince myself of things that may not be true. But with the dowsing rods, it keeps me on the straight and narrow. It really does. It makes me, very much aware. But it does something else that I think is really wonderful too. We tend to treat, probably not too many people listen to this show do this because they're a little more used to this. But especially at the beginning, we tend to treat the spiritual and the other side as some kind of a great woo-woo thing. You know, we talk about it differently, we intone, you know, and all this kind of thing. And I'm just convinced, you know, what we call real, and I mean that with a small r, what we call real is just the landscape that is inside of this fivefold fence that we live of our senses. And on the other side is reality with a capital R. The reality that we call real in our science studies here is only one part of a greater reality. So I'm convinced that there is a science to understanding that greater reality. It may not be a science that we understand yet. We haven't deciphered it yet. Mm-hmm. But I'm convinced that it's real, and we don't need to treat it as if it's some kind of mystical apparition or anything like that. Dimensions are real. Parallel dimensions are real. Beings in those parallel dimensions are real. And then the funny thing is, I've been preaching this all my life without realizing it. I would stand up at Christmas, hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn king. What am I singing about? A bunch of interdimensional beings stepping forth into our reality and singing, producing vibration, which to us sounds like singing. And I've been preaching that all my life, and I never accepted it. The fact that there were real angelic beings, real spiritual beings who can come into this life if we're only open to receiving it. Huh. And lo and behold, it seems so perfectly natural now that I wonder how I could have lived my whole life without realizing something so close and so powerful and so meaningful and not knowing it because I just was sucked into believing only what was going on in my brain.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, when you're talking about this reality and this greater reality with a capital R, it sounds, in a scientific sense, it sounds kind of like the physicist David Bohm's implicate mm-hmm. and explicate order. Yeah, are you familiar with those?
Yes, that's one thing that I find very exciting because, of course, the Hindu rishis were intuiting all this stuff 6,000 years ago mm-hmm. or more, you know. But now, through a totally different language, through the language of mathematics, physicists in the last 100 years have started to explore this world too. Mm-hmm. They're using a different language, but it's the same world. And we now, I think, live in a generation at a time in history, if there is such a thing as history, but we live at a time when science and spirituality, which have been on two separate paths ever since Galileo, now all of a sudden they're starting to merge onto one highway. And if we can begin to merge those two and take that seriously, wow, we could change life as on this planet as we know it. I'm hoping it's happening.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so near-death experiences then are like a link between the two realities then.
I think they are. And although I've never had a near-death experience, and the terrible thing about near-death experiences, in order to have a near-death experience, you actually have to die. And I've never done that. I've never been flatlined. But I have had a lot of out-of-body experiences. And seen from what I can see from my interviews of people who have had near-death experiences, we seem to have seen the same landscape. Mm-hmm. Now, people say, well, what does it look like over there? Well, I can't tell you what it looks like. I can only tell you what it looks like to me. Because I think every single person who has a near-death experience or who has an out-of-body experience in which he travels outside of the body, it's so foreign to us, of course, because we're just so used to this material world. It's so foreign to us that it's hard for us to find words to explain it. It's like waking up from a dream that was so vivid and so real, and then 5 minutes later, you try to explain it, and it sounds dumb, you know. But I think what we do is we can't say this is the way it was. I think all we can do is say this is the way it seemed like to me, because I carried my own Rolodex of experiences with me, and whatever I experienced over there was translated through experiences that I've had here that I could understand. So I could say, I saw a tree. Well, I probably didn't really see a tree. I saw something where the best I can understand it is my brain says, well, it's kind of like a tree, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with entities that communicate. People have asked me how, you know, you said you got a message. How did they give you the message? Why did they speak English? I love that one.
Yeah.
and the answer is, well, they didn't. And I wasn't either. It doesn't. And I've talked to a lot of people who have had near-death experiences who say the same thing. They receive these messages, and it's not like they are being communicated to line by line, word by word, like we communicate to each other now. It comes almost as a block of teaching in its full, final form. And we just know. We can't explain how we know. And when we come back here and try to put it into words, it doesn't work, because words just don't work over here. But we just know. And that's how it happens. So it's not a matter of, I think, spirits learning English or learning French or, you know, that kind of, I don't even think there's a spiritual language, because I don't think we communicate that way. It comes through a whole psychic block of teaching that just seems to come. Perfect communication, of which all the communication we do is worthless. I like to describe it like this. You sit down, and, you know, being trained as a classical musician, there are certain composers that just really push my buttons. Brahms, I can listen to a Brahms symphony, and I can just be transported through a Brahms symphony. And someone says, why is that so beautiful? Well, I can say, well, because in measure four, he used a 4-3 suspension, and in measure six, that isn't why it's beautiful. You know, it's vibration that is transported through us, and it comes to us as sound in our ears, but it conveys something that's just much deeper. And so we can be sitting here crying and not even know why, you know, but we just know that it's real. It's real.
And it literally resonates with potentially the very basic building blocks, which may be little tiny vibrating fibers.
Strings, it could very well be.
Having OBEs before you went to the Institute?
No. Oh, well, yes. No. Before I went to the Institute, I did. As a matter of fact, that's what made me want to go there, because I had had four or five out-of-body experiences, which were very powerful, and I felt I was just beginning to try to start to tap into this. And when I had the opportunity to go study with Bill for a week, I said, I got to take it.
What did you learn? I mean, did you learn how to refine the OBE or what?
Yes, I think so. I learned how to refine mainly techniques. He's very big on techniques. And he also said that, you know, anybody can have an out-of-body experience, he was convinced, as long as you were willing to spend 30 minutes a day for 30 days. And that's what I did. Although if I'd stopped on day 28, I wouldn't be talking to you now. But at any rate, you learn how to use certain techniques. And there's also something else in there, because you're in a group. It's a small group, but it's still a group. And to share the stories and to live together with these people for a week. And some of them were just opening up and had their first out-of-body experience that week while we were there. And to hear the stories, and it gives you a certain feedback. It puts you into a loop and gets you away from this world. Because, you know, we didn't know. We weren't watching television. We weren't listening to radio. We weren't reading the newspaper. We didn't know what's going on in the world. We were just totally enmeshed in this one single focal point. And I think that's one of the troubles with the world that we live in today. It's so busy and we're all multitasking all the time and it's so loud. And that's why I live in the woods. Days go by, I don't see anybody. Matter of fact, one of the biggest troubles I have is I have to keep a trickle charger for my car battery because I don't use it enough. I have to charge it up every once in a while because I never use it. And that's about it. So it's, for me, the only way that it really would have worked was not to go on a little retreat here or there, but to really get away. And not everybody can do that. I feel tremendously blessed that it just worked out for me.
Do you have a dog?
I did.
Oh, okay. You need a dog. That's what I was just thinking. Like, Liz Woodsy needs a dog.
Well, I kind of do. I built this house out in the woods and down through a little path through the woods. I built a house for my daughter. She was willing to give up her life, put her whole life on hold and come out here to help me as I get older. I just celebrated my 78th birthday and there are things I just can't do anymore. So she came out here to help me, but along that time, the way she became, first of all, my tech guru, and then then she became the one who sets up all my schedules and does all of this and records all this and does all the videos that we have up on our YouTube channel and all that kind of stuff. And she has a dog, which feels just as comfortable over here as over there.
Okay.
So Lena is Jan's dog, but once in a while I can sneak her in here too.
Okay, that's good.
Jim, were you writing books before you moved to the woods, or is that when you started?
Well, yes, I did write my first book, which is a book about long distance bicycling. it's called the Inner Life of a Long Distance Bicycle.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
And it was about the spirituality of the whole thing. And I did write that before, while I was still in ministry, and because of that book, it happened to land on the shelf of an editor at Visible Ink Press, and they were looking for somebody who could write a one-volume encyclopedia on world religions. And
wow.
I was their second choice because the first guy backed out. But I happened to be teaching a college course at the time on world religions, comparative religion. And so one of the things I offered to them was kind of a syllabus of the words that we use, and that became the basis for the religion book. And one thing led to another, and I did write a couple of books before I retired. But since I retired, I think I've written probably, I don't know, 16, 17 books, something like that. And all different subjects. That's what's fun. I finished this one on near-death experiences that just came out this month, April 9th. Mm-hmm. And I've got another one coming out in October about, it's called Lost Loot, and it's all about treasures and cursed treasures and everything from Captain Kidd's treasure to the lost Dutchman mine. And now I'm working on one about Bigfoot sightings. So it's,
all right.
it keeps you bouncing around a little right. bit.
And have you had any sightings in your woods? A Bigfoot?
I don't know. I think so. But there have been no sightings in the county where I live from anybody else. But I think I have had one experience. However, it wasn't a sighting, but it was... it was something that was so real to me that it became the introduction to this book, as a matter of fact.
Because I've noticed that when you focus, especially when writing a particular type of book, sometimes the experiences happen to you.
Yes, yes, so, absolutely.
You become immersed.
I think it attracts it.
Uh-huh.
I think so too. Whatever you're immersed in, I think it tends to attract it, which made me then too, when I was writing about near-death experiences, for instance, I kept having all that stuff that had been drummed into my head as a kid, you know, God's going to get you for that, you know. He knows when you've been sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows when you've been good or bad, so be good for goodness sake, and all that negativity.
Yeah.
And I was amazed at when I wrote about near-death experiences. It was just such a positive, wonderful thing. It seemed to attract it, and I think it's the same way with this, with any other book you write. You tend to attract, and it it tends to bring good stuff. And so I've come into this writing about Bigfoot. I've changed my idea. I don't see it. Bigfoot is a big, ferocious creature. I mean, if one showed up and knocked on my door, I'd invite him in for a cup of tea.
You know, that he's going to be your pet.
Yeah. or I could be his.
You could be his. Yeah.
But, you know, I just tend to think that a lot of these things that are so-called supernatural or metaphysical, and we have it, you know, fear is one of our greatest enemies. We tend to fear this kind of stuff. And my way of thinking is just the opposite now. I've had, I had one, I think, of all the out-of-body experiences I had one negative experience. And it came after I was halfway through writing the book about out-of-body experiences called The Quantum Akashic Field, a field guide for out-of-body travelers. And when I was writing that book, and I had just written the sentence, the last sentence of the day was that I've never had a negative out-of-body experience. That night I had a negative out-of-body experience. Jeez. And I'm absolutely sure that I attracted it. So that's why I like to tell people who read near-death experiences that it's so important for us to study this stuff first and become comfortable with it first, so that when our time comes to take that step from this reality to the next, I think it's so important for us to be relaxed and positive and looking forward. I think it just makes our transition so much smoother, so much easier.
Do you use any type of protection, anything you say, like a little prayer before you go into these experiences?
I'm ashamed to say that I used to, but I don't much anymore. And I should. I'm not suggesting it. It's just that it's become so second nature much, you know. And on the other hand, once I distinctly remember standing outside the Merry Maiden Stone Circle in Cornwall, and I was there with a mentor of mine who was very active in that area teaching dowsing. And I was back there, and he led me across this field. There was the Merry Maidens. Oh, I've seen pictures, and I've heard stories and everything else. And I just wanted to grab my dowsing rods and run in there and discover stuff that nobody before has ever heard of, you know, and all this kind of thing. And I was just about to go, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he says, "Wait a minute, Jim. Dowsing can lead you down a primrose path really easy. Stop, take a deep breath, get in tune with the spirits, ask their permission." And I've never forgotten that. It was so important. I'd love to say I always do it, but all I can say is I've never forgotten that. I don't always do it. And I say that to my detriment. I really do.
We had go ahead, Trish.
No, go ahead. I was going to ask him about it.
Yeah, we had somebody on the podcast a couple of weeks ago who gave us a very brief phrase for protection in case of, you know, sensing anything negative coming your way. And it's just four words: shields up, mirrors out.
Wow. I love it.
Yeah, I love that.
I love it.
Very simple.
I love it. You know, I don't really necessarily say a prayer, but I guess now that I think about it, I always stop and just try to take a deep breath and calm myself before I start dowsing. So maybe that is, in a sense, maybe that's my shorthand now for a prayer, but I like that. Yeah. Shields.
What do you use for dowsing?
What kind of dowsing tool? I hate to tell people what it is. When I first started dowsing, it came to me that, you know, I never wanted to learn how to douse. I had seen people do it, but I didn't think anything of it much. And until one day, all of a sudden, I said, "I want to learn how to douse." So I went down to my local hardware store, and they don't sell dowsing rods in a hardware store.
No Ace Hardware dowsing rods.
So I said, "Well, what do you have, you know, for copper wire?" And he had some big, you know, thick copper wire. And I said, "Give me two 18, 19-inch pieces of that." So he said, "Okay." So he gave it to me. I didn't tell him what it was for. I brought home and I bent them into the shape of an L. They're called L rods. And I've used them ever since. I've been to seminars where they have all these, you know, shops set up where you can go in and you can buy these expensive dowsing rods and everything else. And I always feel kind of silly when I'm dowsing with any real dowser and I show up with a couple of bent up old pieces of copper wire or rod. But that's all I use. They're part of me right now. The pendulum that I use is a little, about a quarter of an inch hole in the middle of a nut, like a bolt on a nut, you know, it's on a, tied with a piece of yarn because that was all I had at the time. And I've been using that now for 12, 15 years. And I just don't see the need for all the expensive stuff and everything else.
You can make a dowsing rod out of a hanger, old hanger.
Take it out. A couple of times when I've been traveling and didn't have my rods with me, I've done just exactly that because I always kick myself if I go someplace that feels really interesting and I don't have my dowsing rods with me.
Yeah.
Of course, if you're flying and you take on copper rods, you may run into a big problem.
That's a problem. When I went to Cornwall, I really debated because I wanted to take my dowsing rods with me, but I was afraid what might happen in an airport. Yeah. So I arranged for a guy out there to have a pair of dowsing rods for me that were happened to be manufactured. They were made by Hamish Miller, who had passed away before I ever met him. I call him a mentor whom I never met. But I did have tea with his wife, Ba, and she's a wonderful, wonderful lady, still in Cornwall. And I figured that any dowsing rods made by Hamish Miller would probably work for me, except he was a welder, and so they were kind of heavy, and Hamish Miller was big, strong guy. And I always felt like they were kind of dragging me forward. But they worked just fine anyway.
Yeah. Huh. So, Jim, in your near-death experience book, you have a lot of references to science and scientists. And could you go into a little bit about this, how scientists typically react to stories of near-death experiences?
Well, it's funny. The genesis of this book, as a matter of fact, goes back now some 50 years, back to the 70s, when I was just out of school and I knew everything, had all the answers and all this kind of stuff, you know. And back then, I had an experience with a woman in the book. I call her Hannah.
That was my next question.
she was just a dear old lady. And she was in the hospital room, and I was told that she probably wouldn't come out, but she didn't know that. And it was back in those days, back in the early 70s, doctors, hospitals just didn't pay much attention to that, really. They do now, I think, a lot of them do. But back then they didn't. And I was standing in her room. I had gotten into the habit of taking my guitar with me when I went to visit her because she loved the old hymns of the church. So I'd do the old Rugged Cross or In the Garden, and I'd sing. And sometimes nurses would wheel other patients in and all this kind of stuff. But this particular time, which happened to be the last time I saw her alive, I was standing there at the foot of her bed, putting my guitar away. And she said, "Who did you bring with you?" And this time. And I said, "I'm all by myself, Anna." And she kind of gave me a knowing smile, like she knew something I didn't, and said, "Oh, they usually wait for you to go. I think the music attracts them." Mm-hmm. Well, it never occurred to me that music is vibration. And just the music of the vibrating guitar strings could have been bringing forces in. But then she said something which I just never forgot. She said, "They usually wait till you go, and then they come in through the portal." And I thought, portal, the door. I looked at the door. I'm going out and into the hallway. She couldn't see out the door. There was a curtain in front of her bed on that side. And I looked out there, and the hallway was empty. And I didn't want to confuse her, so I said, "Okay, yeah, okay, Anna, fine, you know, great. See you next time." And I put the guitar away. But on my way out, I stopped by the nurse's station, and I said, "What was Hannah talking about? The people coming in through the portal?" And the nurse said, "Oh, she's been talking like that for a couple of days. She probably doesn't have long to live. And sure enough, she died that night.
Mm.
But I never forgot it. 50 years went by. And another couple who were friends of mine from my old church after I retired, they came out here to the woods to see me. And he had said, you know, my mother died. And I said, yeah, I had heard. And it was too bad. And he said, I was with her when she died. And she said something really funny. She said, now, who have you brought with you? And what? And she said, yeah, they come in through the portal sometimes after.
Jeez.
The very same thing that Anna had said 50 years earlier. It took me that long to finally begin to say to myself, oh, Jim, how could you have wasted all of this time? All of the people who I was with when they died, you know, as a pastor of a church, sometimes holding their hand, sometimes praying with them. And sometimes they would die and then come back and they would tell me about, or not even die, but tell me about having visions of seeing a being of light or a loved one, a father, a mother, somebody, always in the prime of life. And me, because I knew everything, after all, I'd been in school, right? I would just nod, you know, oh, that's great, that's great, that's great. Oh, what I could have learned had I just been more open-minded, and it would have been totally different. But these things happen. I got a call one night from a nurse in the hospital, called me at 3 o'clock in the morning. And she said, Reverend Willis, I know that it's early in the morning. And I said, yeah, middle of the night, as far as I'm concerned. She says, can you get down here? Your friend from your church is dying and he's asking for you. And I said, oh, absolutely. So I got on my clothes and got in my car and drove to the hospital. I went in, and if you ever wanted to see a successful man, Brad was it. He had two doctorates. He had started a university, which is still flourishing to this day. He was a pillar of the church, pillar of the community. Everybody loved him. Great guy, accomplished everything. If you wanted to look up success, just look up S in the dictionary, and there's Bradley's picture looking out at you, you know. And I knew him very well, so I didn't have to beat around the bush. And I say, Brad, are you ready to go? And he started to cry. And I said, What is it, Brad? He says, Jim, he says, I'm an old kid. I've lived a successful life. I know it. I know I've done a lot of good, and I know it's been a worthwhile life, but I didn't do the one thing that I needed to do. And I said, what was that? He said, I never prepared for this moment. He never prepared for his own death. And we were very fortunate. He didn't die that night. He lasted 10 more days, and I saw him every day during those 10 days. And we talked about spirituality. We talked about religion. We talked about philosophy. We talked about everything. I don't know if I taught him anything in those 10 days, but I know he taught me an awful lot. And it was just, it kind of haunted me. And every once in a while, I see people living their lives and measuring success in ways that are just not important, and how much money they have, or what kind of a new car they have, or house they live in, or anything like that. I find people measuring success like that, and I think of Bradley saying, I never prepared for the most important moment of my life, the day I'm going to die. Huh. And I'm thinking, boy, that's, if people take from this conversation, people who listen or who will read my book, if they only take one thing away, it's that, boy, preparing for the inevitable end that's going to come to every single one of us, no matter who we are, preparing for that and doing the life review while you're still alive, looking back on your life, and not in a judgmental way, but in gathering the experiences so that we can deposit them when we leave in the Akashic record, or some people call it the book of life, or whatever it is. That's the most important thing we can do in life. And instead, we spend all of our lives doing things that are unimportant. And it's a shame. It's a shame.
Jim,
one thing in real quick is Bradley was very lucky, because if I'm ever when I get to that point in life, I either want Jim's voice or Morgan Freeman's voice being the one.
No, exactly.
Keeping me anchored here until I get there. Yeah.
That means more to me than you can imagine. I have so much respect for Morgan Freeman.
Yeah. He's just great.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever had any contact with either this man or Hannah since they passed?
No, I haven't. Neither one of them. I have had contact with people who have passed. One especially, I met her with her three times. Her name was Sarah, and she had died in Germany some years ago. And she was so tied into this life. I think probably the war had made her so enamored of the family, some of whom she had lost and everything else, had just tied her down. So when she died, she couldn't let go. And she was living in kind of a gray nothingness. It wasn't a punishment or anything. And she was seemed to be very happy, didn't know any better, but she couldn't let go. And after my third time meeting with her, an out-of-body experience, I was able to usher her past out of that into the light. Now, since I did that, and of course, me ego sets in, I think, oh, look what I did, you know. Now I'm discovering at Monroe Institute, they have old courses in doing that.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
the work of the psychopomp, you know, helping people. But I had never heard of it. So I just thought this first time this ever happened in my life, in the world, you know. It's just very important. I think back, and this has happened two other times, and I think back it's just so important for us to come to grips with that, just for that reason, so that when the time comes for us to pass, we can hear the voice of Morgan Freeman saying, "Well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your life."
Jim, can you relate that to the phrase you have in your book, that you can't pour new wine into an old wineskin?
There's a wonderful story in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 2 and verse 22, where Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he's telling them that, you know, if you pour new wine that hasn't fermented yet into old, dried out, cracked wineskins, when the wine begins to ferment and work, it'll break the skin. It'll just flow out on the ground. It won't help anything. You'll have to put new wine into new wineskins that are still pliable and will work with it and be able to expand and contract along with the yeasty wine as it ferments. And I think we have been trying to take the new understandings of spirit, the new understandings of it's you know, the wine of the spirit, so to speak, and it's just beginning to ferment and beginning to open up, and it's coming from not only the religious or the spiritual side, it's also coming from the scientific side. And if we pour that into our old ways of understanding, they just simply won't handle it. Academia, and I was a college teacher. I was a professor for many years. Academia can do some great things, but it also has a tendency to get very cracked and dried and brittle. When professors stand up and lecture their class, and then 2 years later, new information comes which says, all of that old stuff that I taught you, it doesn't work anymore. They have a tendency instead to fight against it and say, no, I was right, and that's all there is to it. You know, we have it. And when that happens, I don't think it contain it. So what I'm talking about is taking all of this wonderful new freedom of spirituality that is in the world today, and if we pour it into the old containers that have been around forever, they just won't hold it. They're going to break. And instead, we need flexible thinking. We need new ways of thinking. We need new ways of experiencing. And that's, that, to me, is very important.
Yeah, it's not only the academic ways, but also the religious ways.
Maybe especially, especially
Jesus is the only way, and, you know, eliminating, you know, 5/6 of the world's population or whatever.
I just shake my head sometimes. You know, when you get the people who's, what was that expression that I heard one Southern Baptist preacher say? He says, our preachers may not always be right, but they're never in doubt. and, you know, that's one thing that religions have a way of encapsulating and building fences instead of bridges and building walls. And I never understood why it would be a bad thing for me to sit down as a Christian minister, say, and talk to a Jewish rabbi. I did it all my life. Or talk to a Hindu, or talk to, you know, a Muslim or a Buddhist. To me, it was always enlightening. I didn't want to, you know, convert them to my way of thinking. Wow. I was just interested in what they thought and how they thought. The thing that changed my life completely was meeting somebody in a totally different kind of an environment who had a totally different view on life, but was very interested in what I had to say just because she was excited about it. And I was excited about what she had to say. And that experience happened on a mountaintop of all things. Mm-hmm. And that experience changed me forever. And I just don't see why we have to be afraid of talking with people who differ with us instead of making prisons around, you know, and this is the way, you know, it just it doesn't work.
There is no single way.
No.
Since you studied NDE so much, explain to us, if you can, summarize, what happens when you die? I mean, what is the spiritual process?
Well, there seems to be, from what people bring back, and everybody's story is different. I listen to a lot of NDEs testimonies on YouTube, for instance, and I see how easy it is for people to say, this is what's going to happen. This is the way it is. And I just don't think that's the case. I think this is the way it happened for them.
Yeah.
And it was very meaningful, and so that was the way it was. But there seem to be certain things that are repeated over and over again. The idea of floating out of the body and then looking down, if you're in a hospital, for instance, looking down and seeing the body and seeing people work on you. And that's become so commonplace now that hospitals are even doing experiments. They're putting signs pointing toward the ceiling that only can be read from above. And when if a person comes back, what did the sign say? And often the person can tell them what the sign said.
Wow.
Or the story about a person finding an old there's a shoe on the ledge outside the window. You know,
that's
that
a great story.
That is a great story.
Yeah. And so that's one thing. It begins with that, what I would call the out-of-body experience. Mm-hmm. They usually go through another set of formulas, and one of them is a tunnel or a tube or something like that, and going through that tunnel toward a light. There's always the light there, and there is a being of light that meets them. They almost always talk about a life review where their whole life flashes before their eyes. We've even talked about this in our own language. You know, we said, oh, man, I thought I was going to die. My life flashed before my eyes. Well,
right.
that's because that's what happens. But it's important for us to understand, I don't think this life review is a judgment. I don't think it says, we're going to review your life to see if you're good enough to go on to heaven or wherever. I think we have come here to gather experience. This is a school of experience. And we've come here to gather these experiences. And I think the life review is a matter of taking those experiences and depositing them, so to speak, in the Akashic record or the book of life or whatever, because that's what we came here to get, experience. And that's what the life review is. Now, there are some things we'd like to change, I'm sure. I mean, every time I hear somebody say, well, I wouldn't change a thing in my life, I say, well, then you don't know very much. Because I think all of us would would benefit from making some changes or not doing some of the things we did or doing some of the things we didn't do. But I don't think it's that life review is the idea of you know, God's going to get you for that, see if you're good enough, that kind of thing. That's not that. It's to gather those experiences together. And then usually, if some of them have gone far enough to describe a certain kind of landscape, and those are always different. Sometimes it's a landscape of light and clouds. Sometimes it's a landscape that looks like a park or something like that. It's a welcoming thing. Hmm. And I think probably the reason that we have those experiences are because if we were to travel strictly from this life right to the next, which is totally different than a material life, I think it'd probably be too big a shock. We'd probably have a hard time with it. So I think we carry with us some of the old life. And we gradually make our way into the new reality. One thing that people almost always say is they were welcomed, welcomed by people who of perfect love, perfect compassion, perfect acceptance. Mm-hmm. I have yet to talk to one person who got that far and wanted to come back. Most of them, they didn't want to come back. They wanted to stay. They said it was the most beautiful thing in the world.
Even children, too.
Yeah, children, the same thing. And they didn't want to come back. But they were told or made to understand somehow that there was a reason for it. They had to come back, and so they did. I've had that experience quite a few times in out-of-body experiences when I was so out there. And it was just so wonderful, and it was so comforting. And then I realized I had to get back to my body, and I didn't want to. And frankly, I'm looking forward to the day when someday I would have that kind of out-of-body experience, and instead of making the choice to come back, I
just keep going.
Keep going. And that would be the kind of death I would love to die.
Yeah. Jim, in your studies of religion, what about reincarnation? Have you found, did reincarnation exist in early Christianity? Were the is that a
yes in early Christianity, and even in some places in Christianity even today, I've talked to more and more Christian theologians who as they say, I can make room in my theology for reincarnation. Well, it that says something right there, doesn't it?
Right.
I can make room in my theology. But it was there in the beginning, and I think it goes back so many ways. Now, there's the big argument is, does reincarnation happen consecutively, meaning are those lives that we lived earlier, or are those lives just different dimensions that are happening all because time gets in the way. We don't understand time.
Yeah.
To my way of thinking, it doesn't make any difference, which it is. The point is that we come for experience, and one lifetime is not enough to give us enough experience, I don't think. And so it takes, many of us have the privilege of living over and over and over again and gathering up ever that much more experience until finally we say, nope, that's it. I'm done.
We had a woman on, a South African woman who's a healer, and she claims she remembers 70 past lives.
Wow.
Now, I don't know where you put those kind of memories, but my God, you'd have to have a big hard drive.
Wow. Well, yeah, there again, too. I have no doubt, you know, that is, that is the case. It's just so much bigger than all of us. And the experience of reality with a capital R is just so huge that I think there's just no end to the stories you hear, and I'm always fascinated by them. I love to hear little children who have, they aren't even in school yet, but they can talk about their past lives. And no one has taught them that. You know, they just remember.
That's spontaneous.
Yeah, when it just comes out. And then as they get older, you know, they tend to fade out, just like dreams can be so real at the beginning. But as we go through the day, we even forget what the dream was about, that kind of thing. And I think it has to be that way, because if we come here to gather experience and we're aware of the fact that that's why we're here, to gather experience, then that's going to influence us. And that also gives me a kind of a comfort when I'm down, when I'm sick, or when I'm hurting, or if there are relationship problems or worry about this or worry about that. I take a great comfort in knowing that that's one of the reasons I came here, to gather experience. Wow. Only thing is, experiences can't always be good. There's bad experiences too. And we came to experience those as much as the good. So instead of worrying about it and beating myself up about it, I find it much more easy to just say, that's why I'm here. So I might as well get down and revel in it. If I'm going to be sick, boy, I'm going to be sick, and I'm going to gather up every little thing I can from it, because that's an experience I came here to have. Mm. And that gives me a great deal of hope. It really does.
That's a really positive outlook also.
Yeah, I wish I could do it all the time. to people who have any notions about this guru who lives out in the woods, trust me, do what I say, don't do what I do. I'm just as guilty as anybody else about forgetting sometimes, and then I have to remind myself and then get over just the intellectual part of it and begin to really feel it down deep inside, that this is happening for a reason. And now I've got to accept it and or internalize it and go with it.
Hmm. So you mentioned...
Oh, go ahead.
You mentioned a couple of your books coming out, and you have a lot in the past. Is there any one particular one that you find the most, you think people would be most interested in, or that you're most?
Well, I have a little gem that's my favorite. It's my first and only work of fiction. It's called The Wizard in the Wood.
Okay.
I love it, and I could not find a publisher for it. So my daughter and I published it ourselves, not only in paperback, but also in digital. And I did an audio version of it, too.
Yeah. And I was going to ask that, because yeah. I'm going to go buy that.
Yeah.
I love his voice.
I just love it. It was so much fun, because I had never done an audio book before. And we just felt that this should be an audio book. So... it's a story, kind of a coming-of-age story about a boy who wanders up on a hill and meets a kind of a wizard in the wood, so to speak, a mentor, and the story of his life. And we had fun with the audiobook, because I said, you know, if I'm going to do this, let's do it right. I wanted a lot of music, and I was in touch with a long-distance friend of mine who I'd never met in person, but he's a wonderful musician from India. His name is Ajit Padmanabh. And he did the music for the book.
Wow.
And when it came time, there was one chapter, for instance, where the guy is he's a soldier in Vietnam. The kid grows up, and he's in Vietnam. And we needed all the fireworks and all the sounds of war and everything else. And it turned out that it was recorded the day before 4th of July. So Jan could just go out with her thing and record the fireworks going off on the lake near us. And then she would go out during a rainstorm and capture the rain coming down and all the night sounds and everything else. And we had a ball with it. So yeah, I don't know how profound the book is, but it's my favorite. There's no doubt about it.
Great.
The other one right off the top of my head, I love another book that I wrote called Cosmo and Me, which is kind of an autobiography. It goes back to take decades of American history, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. And each one of those decades had a flavor to it, that if you were going to be a spiritual seeker, you had to do certain things. In the 50s, you went to church. In the 60s, you went out in the streets. In the 70s, you did this. In the 80s, you did that. And so I followed my life through seven decades in this way. Yeah. Cosmo and Me is the name of that one.
Yeah, interesting.
Good title.
Where can we learn more about your work?
Easiest thing to do is just go to my website, www.jimwillis.net. It has all the books, all the reviews, and you can just click on them, and it'll take you to different sites where you can get them. But it also has a contact page, and I really encourage people to use that contact page, because they can contact me, send me an email. You know, you and I can talk to each other and see each other, but we have no idea who's out there. And I love to meet the community of people who are thinking in these in this way. So that's a way to get in touch, and I try to answer everyone that I can.
How can we bottle up your voice?
Oh. Well, thank you. I didn't think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for coming on.
Yeah, this has been great, Jim. It's been so interesting.
Very enjoyable.
Well, thank you. It's been great being with you. I really appreciate it.
Now, John, when is this one going up?
It will be a week from today. Okay. But also, I'm on audible.com right now, and I just added The Wizard in the Wood to my cart. So.
Oh. All right.
Thank you so much. Great to hear.
Yeah. Good talking to you.
So we'll send you the link when it goes up, Jim.
Thank you. Really appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks again. You have a good day.
Keep up the great work you're doing. It's wonderful.
Well, this is fun. We meet a lot of interesting people, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Take care.
Have a good day. Thank you.
Thanks for joining the Mystical Underground. Visit www.themysticalunderground.com for the latest blog post and book info. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. Listen to the podcast at podcast.themysticalunderground.com. Follow Trish and Rob on Instagram at Trish and Rob McGregor. Follow us on Twitter at The Mystic Cast. Send email to podcast@themysticalunderground.com. And until next week, thank you for listening and stay mystical.